we're recording.
Oh, good. I got makeup on today, so I'd look good on the show.
Yeah, it's an audio. It's like a radio show, Jim.
I'm ready to go.
Okay, so, all right, here's what we'll do. We'll start out, as always, by introducing each other.
Oh, all right.
This is the Double Feature Review Podcast.
And, it is.
And I'm Douglas Lane, and you're Jim Ferris.
Wait a minute. You're introducing yourself. I'm confused.
I'm just saying my name because I know it's so difficult for you to say my name or to introduce me. I'm just giving a little bit of an intro for myself, but I'm not going to do the whole thing. Wait, so, okay, Jim Ferris is my co-host. He's a former...
It's me, Jim Ferris.
That's right. He's a former screenwriter. He's a former tour guide with Universal Studios. He's a former comedian. He is former in many, many ways, except he is still with us, and he's here today.
That's right.
As my co-host on the Double Feature Review Podcast. So,
formerly Jim, almost dead, but now
no, yes, you're middle aged.
Well, some people seem to be amazed that I'm still here.
Yeah, some of your friends were so delighted to hear your voice.
Some of them were like, "Oh, listening to you reminds me of like when you were alive." Yes. I am.
Yeah.
I haven't fallen in love with my operating system. It's still me.
Right. Exactly. I don't know what that means about the operating system, but yes. And Dana Snow is one of the people who
is a great comedian. Dana Snow, or the Snowball, as I used to affectionately call him.
Mm-hmm.
Never.
He reached out to you.
He did. And I wish he wouldn't do that.
Yeah. You could, press charges, I think.
I have in the past.
But all right, so now, so that's that. You are you, and we're all pleased about that. Now it's your turn. You can introduce me.
And back from his national tour publicizing his new book, Finding Neverland, it's Douglas Sir Write-A-Lot, Douglas Lane.
That's perfect. I don't know. I did not write a book called Finding Neverland. Isn't that the sequel to Hook?
No, it's not the sequel. It's about Peter Pan, though. It's about John Barry. Sir John Barry.
J.M. Barry, who wrote the Peter Pan book.
Who wrote books. Peter Pan.
Yeah, book.
You don't know because you wrote it.
Yeah, it's a play. It was a play, Peter Pan.
Uh-huh.
And then it was a book.
That's
then,
right.
Then it was a major motion picture.
Several times, yes.
And then it was a play again.
It was a play again. Usually women play Peter Pan for some reason.
That's right.
And he's a boy, so I don't quite understand.
Because they want someone who can act but still look like a boy. And if they put a man in the role, he's too mature. So they put someone like Sandy Duncan.
Androgynous. Yeah, I guess. They had Kathy Rigby, play Peter Pan. And Mary Martin played her originally.
You know who they would not put in that role?
Ethel Merman?
Well, maybe not. She's dead. But
I was thinking
like Dolly Parton.
No, you wouldn't.
You wouldn't want someone who's really developed.
You know what it is? On stage, you hang these people with wires. And if somebody is too dramatically weighted one direction or another, the wires could get all...
I think they could probably balance that. I think they could probably do something to balance that out.
I think somebody in the audience at some point would yell, "Oh, the humanity!" And then she would crash.
Our films that we're going to do and on the double feature review, what we do is
by the way, speaking of the double feature review, I'm very pleased. I checked the Crosley rating service and the Nielsen service. Turns out our little podcast here has higher ratings than the Winter Olympics did. So
that's great.
Yeah, I'm very pleased.
Did the Winter Olympics happen this year? Again? Was that this year?
So what are we going to talk about now?
Okay, so we're going to be talking about two movies, because that's what we do on the Double Feature Review. We take a look at two movies. They're often thematically linked. They're linked in some way, whether or not they're on the same kind of subject matter, or if they have maybe they share a few actors.
Mm-hmm.
We will be looking at films like that both star Tom Cruise. For instance, we might do that. We haven't yet, but that's an idea.
Maybe.
That's just a thought. But somehow they're linked. This week we have, or this month, we're doing it monthly at the moment. We have two films that are linked through the writer, Joseph Heller. We've got Sex and the Single Girl.
Yes.
Which is a 1964 comedy.
Comedy based on the Helen Gurley Brown book, Sex and the Single. He wrote.
And Joseph Heller wrote the screenplay. Right. Yeah. And you got Tony Curtis. You got Natalie Wood. You got Henry Fonda. Lauren Bacall.
Mm-hmm.
And yep. You got a whole bunch of silly Technicolor nonsense in that.
Oh, one. You sure do.
And then what about, we're talking about 10 years later, like 74?
1970.
So 6 years later.
6 years later.
Joseph Heller's book, Catch 22.
Made into a movie.
He didn't write the screenplay. He didn't have anything to do with the movie, really, but he wrote the book that it's based on, and we watched those two films.
That's right.
And I think we should just go through it in order. I think we should start with Sex and the Single Girl.
Oh, yeah.
And then do Catch 22.
Mention sex, and the single girl is cool and shy. She objects to discussing sex with any guy. You can bet she's as interested as he. If sex weren't 50-50, where would everybody be? Mention sex, and the single girl will blush a lot. Though she wrecks every single guy with what she's got, then a guy she can't ignore tells her what she's waited for, and suddenly she's not single anymore.
Yeah, Sex and the Single Girl, I think, was I've seen it a couple of times in the last few years, and I think it was better than I thought it was. It's still very thin and very silly and very light. It's just a better comedy, I guess, than I thought it was.
Mm-hmm.
They basically bought in the early 70s when Woody Allen did Everything You Always Want to Know About Sex. It was sort of the same process. Essentially, the studio bought a title. They bought the book, the rights to make the movie of this book, but had no intention of making a major motion picture based on basically a sex manual, you know, or whatever.
Right.
And Sex and the Single Girl was kind of a handbook for modern woman at that time by Helen Gurley Brown, kind of an early feminist voice. And Warner Brothers essentially bought the title and then made a movie of whole cloth about something else that they hired Joseph Heller to do. And I think his viewpoint of the world is reflected here to a degree. Kind of, I feel like I'm out of place. It's kind of an insane world, and the world looks kind of crazy to me, and here's how it looks crazy in some ways. And silly, really silly, but nicely cast and nicely produced and funny, I thought.
Yeah. I think that calling Helen Gurley Brown a feminist might be overstating it.
It might be. I think there was no such thing at that time. So
I guess what we think of as feminism really started in the 70s, maybe. But there were certainly feminist people who were politically active, who were struggling for the rights of women.
Oh, absolutely.
And Helen Gurley Brown, I just looked her up. She was the editor of Cosmo magazine for like 32 years. She was not, Cosmo is hardly, at least by today's standards, considered like a feminist magazine. So Helen Gurley Brown's book, taken up by Joseph Heller, and he had to invent the whole, everything about it, really. The only thing that she contributed was the title and the book, the fact, and she's basically a character in the movie.
I know. I'm surprised at that she's the character named the character in the movie. Not just her first name, but I mean, she is the character Natalie Wood plays. It's
right. Right. Only she's not just a writer. She's a psychiatrist. And I don't know if that's...
I don't think that's...
that's accurate. But, yeah, it was a, it's a funny little film. It was... I thought it was cute, and it was better than I thought. I think it, a lot of what made it work, what really makes it stand up, is the, are the performances.
Oh, yeah, it's solid. Very, very nicely done commercial Hollywood comedy. Henry Fonda and Lauren Bacall, I think, add real resonance to these little slight parts that are very thin. But they make it better, I think, just generally. And
Natalie Wood and is
Natalie
like
Wood,
to watch.
Natalie Wood and Tony Curtis are the perfect kind of American couple to be in a movie like that. Doris Day and Rock Hudson were their counterparts at that point. And I think they stand right there with them as doing this kind of material with particularly Tony Curtis. He was just really good at that kind of comedy. And the comedy actors that support it, Stubby Kaye and Larry Storch and all these people, are very good, very solid in these small comedy supporting roles. Edward Everett Horton, who plays the editor of the magazine, the smutty magazine that Tony works for, was in so many great movies, great Hollywood comedies over the years.
When we talked earlier, you said that this was very much a 60s comedy, and you just said it again, I think. But for me, there was a metafictional quality, or like a wink and a nod to the audience, that was so profound that made the film seem almost surreal. I mean, is that because I'm looking back on it and to a time where this kind of theatricality was more of the norm, and or was it different from other?
That's an interesting question. I think it was winking at you at that time as well. It was saying that we are self-aware that we're doing one of these movies. It's obviously a kind of Doris Day, Rock Hudson kind of comedy. The difference is they're looking right at the camera and saying, yeah, not so much. But the opportunity to make comments about capitalism and business and modern man and modern woman at that time was a little bit edgier than maybe it would seem now, just a hair. Like the magazine, the Cosmopolitan, you know, women's magazines at that time were like Ladies' Home Journal and things like that. This magazine was taking on your sex life and talking about it, relatively speaking, openly. And that was a big sea change for women, I think, at that time. And for a movie to talk openly about sex, even in a tongue-in-cheek manner, and look right at you and kind of, you know, here's what we're doing. We're going to talk about this. We're going to deal with it in a straightforward, sort of open way, was unique, I think, for that time.
But they didn't really talk about sex in this movie at all.
No, actually. No. But they just using the word sex and directly challenging the audience to deal with that, and it wasn't much of a challenge, but it was something a little bit. They didn't find euphemisms and things. They basically talked about it to a degree, more than maybe a movie did just a few years earlier. You know, this was that 60s transitional time, 64, 65, before you really hit a sexual revolution, but it was kind of brewing under the surface. I think that's there to a degree.
I think you're right. It's all of that is talked about, but the film is remarkably chaste.
Oh, it is. It is. Very little actually happens.
It's really a G-rated film about sex.
Yeah. And it's more pointedly, I think, makes comments about society than it does about sex. I think it talks more about the corporate world and kind of American business than it does about sex in a much more
really overt way. I mean, the whole thing starts out in this editorial meeting at Stop Magazine. Was that supposed to be like Life Magazine? What was
I
that?
I don't think so.
Look Magazine.
It was a magazine that was turning into a smutty rag, and they were very proud of that. And I don't know, but they do. They do.
I know. They go on and on. They just say that off to the side a little bit. They just nail that over and over again on all the ways that they're horrible.
The worst of them
are the best of them.
Oh,
and of course, our hero is the biggest cad around, which is the most important writer they've got.
That's right.
No standards.
Nope.
And no real ideals or ability.
And wanting less, as they were. They're striving to be less, you know, so they can get more support. Oh, they called it a senseless rag. Thank you so much.
Right. Yeah.
And the corporate culture of everything is a nickel and nothing is not about money. Everything's about money. And I mean, the editor of the magazine talks about when his father opened the magazine and so forth and how they're making more money and that it's.
Right. It used to be an institution in America, a respected journal,
yeah,
news and opinion.
That's
but
right.
Now you've systematically brought the standards down, so it's nothing but smut. And I want to thank you all. And he showed like a chart where the profits are going up and
that's
up
right.
and up because it has no standards. It's very cynical. But, you know, so yeah. like not even it's like Network was a cynical movie, but not like this. This is like so cynical that it's just ridiculous. It's just silly. It's like a children's movie. Really.
And look at Henry Fonda's company. I love
the big giant legs in every doorway.
Oh my goodness! The corporate offices for his company.
He runs a hosiery business.
Hosiery company, and it's just legs, giant legs, and curtains, and
yeah. I love the fact that he has headquarters. He has a stage where he's hired women to come out and just model the hosiery.
And there's
a curtain that stops at their waist or below.
That's right. And he knows them all just by their calf and leg. And when his wife shows up, he just knows her from her legs.
Mr. Broderick, the display is ready.
Good. Good, 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 good. Francis, move just a little bit to the right there. Amy, step back just a little. Jeanette, you've been surfing again. Look at those knees. One day you're going to have to decide between Sylvia.
Sylvia, darling, you changed your mind.
Oh, I'm so happy. Girls, look, it's my wife. She used to work here and she married the boss. You see, if you're nice to me, baby, you can marry me.
I was just kidding. First, I'm going to take you to the biggest, most beautiful lunch you ever had in your life.
Girls, you can take the rest of the day off with pay. No, it'll make it an hour and you better be on time.
So I just want to, just off to the side, I just noticed, I typed into Google Helen Gurley Brown earlier and about whether or not she was a feminist. And here's the beginning. It's a CNN story. It says, longtime Cosmopolitan editor Helen Gurley Brown, and apparently she died a little while ago, 2012, said, was a self-described devout feminist. So you've got that, who paradoxically preached that if you're not a sex object, you're in trouble. So, yeah. And that's definitely, that attitude is certainly in this movie. The Natalie Wood's character wants to be clear that, you know, she wants to give advice about how to get men. And, the whole story that Tony Curtis, I mean, he's at the magazine, he wrote a story about her, he's going to try to write another one. What they're investigating is, has she had sex or not? Is she in any position to tell anyone about how to be a sex object if she's never had sex? And, you know, I love the line. It says, either way, if she has or hasn't, it's a crummy story. That kind of was a catch-22 moment in the film, was where, you know, it's no matter whether she's had sex or isn't, she's degraded, so it's perfect.
And again, that kind of straight-on approach to that subject matter wasn't groundbreaking, but it was sort of unique in those films. They always danced around these things to a degree and dressed them up as something else. Or there was some easy explanation or a complicated explanation of somebody having sex where it looked like they were having sex and they thought they were having sex, but they weren't. Or it was somebody else that looked like them, or all these different little plot devices that would make this seem like, you know, yes, she had a baby out of wedlock, but it was really her husband was in the Navy, and there was all this, you know, this basically says, no, we want this, and I want, you know, and they talk about it. And I mean, his seeing his psychiatrist, who of course is her, and it's all a cover story, talking about the way he and his wife and his lack of sexual prowess with his wife and everything was surprisingly frank for a movie that is anything but, really.
Right, that's true. And of course, her job then as his therapist is to help him get it up.
Yes. And they make no bones about that. Well, excuse me, I don't mean
to. They make no bones about.
But I mean, they don't dress it up as something else.
Well, they call
though.
It get helping him with his confidence. It's a euphemism, but yeah. And
I pretty much when he walks around her office and takes cues from the illustrations.
The pictures on the wall that illustrate all the different kinds of neurosis, I guess.
All the neurosis and anxieties that anybody would talk about, she has framed, and what a stupid thing for a psychiatrist to do. So as you're sitting there, if you had a moment, you'd look up and see your maladies portrayed
in these bizarre,
in these horrifying pictures.
Like they're like out of Alice in Wonderland or something.
They really are. I don't know.
It's a strange little film. I think it's much more surreal than maybe you think, because the style and the tone is it's so straight ahead, you know, romantic '60s comedy, zany comedy. Yeah. But it's weird.
It's wacky in a good way, and it's much more. It's got much more comedy. It had more comedy chops than I thought it did. I remember seeing it, not probably it's on television, a few years after it was made, and being younger and so forth, it seemed kind of watered down. It seems more. Well, it's got more going on.
I can see why people would say it's watered down, because it's so clear in its message, and the characters are so thinly drawn that it might seem watered down. But the fact is, it goes so far in that direction that it becomes a little strange.
You know, when I watched it again here a few years ago, in a sense, it kind of reminded me in some ways of really Looney Tune cartoons that sometimes make comments that you don't see coming, and crazy sight gags and stuff. Kind of an almost Tex Avery kind of comedy that I was surprised it had so much of.
Well, there's an unreality to the whole thing. There's one particular cut where I realized that this film, I mean, I should have realized it earlier, but this film is making no concessions to realism. And that's when they cut. I don't remember what they cut, the scene they cut from is, although I believe it's the scene where he's deciding to go to her as a patient to try to crack the story. And the next scene, he's in her office, and they're just standing there looking at each other. And they're not. It's not a freeze frame, although it almost is. But she's glancing around at him, and there's a tension. They're very close, you know. There's a sexual tension between them too, and they just stay in that position for, you know, maybe 5-10 seconds or something like that. And then the scene starts, and that move to make that cut that way, it lets the cat out of the bag that this is, you know, not. There's no reality to this. This is acted. This is a staged scenario, and yet even in that staging, there was as I say, there was sexual tension and everything between them. They're still in character in that moment. So it's very kind of weird choice to do that.
It is. And it makes a comment on movies where the boy and girl see each other and stop and stare and look, you know, kind of dreamily into each other's eyes. In this movie, that happens, but it seems pointedly silly and obvious. And it's like sent various messages all the same.
It's a cut. I mean, it's actually that interstitial moment. It's not, you know, there's a cut and then they just stop. We don't get to see, like, if that had happened, if they were talking and then they stopped and stared at each other for a moment, that would be one thing. It starts with them all in that moment. So it's like, What was that?
I've got the time, and I've got an idea that's going to save the both of us. So let's drink a toast.
To what?
To your marriage and my magazine. Come on.
Please.
Is it forgotten? Is it mostly a forgotten film?
I don't know. I've talked to contemporaries my age who remember it but don't remember it particularly fondly. And some people who do really hold it as something that kind of resonates more as they've seen it, as they've grown through their life. But a lot of people just kind of dismiss it as being a silly movie from the early 60s. And I think if you go back and look at it again or look at it, you'll see that there's, like so many films, there's something else going on here that's actually better than you might think. That's what struck me, was that it was just fundamentally more interesting, and there was more stuff to note and think about than I would have ever guessed when I decided to look at it again.
I agree with you completely, and it makes me want to go back through that genre and that era and look a little more closely at films that seem dated and maybe naive and see what's going on, because this film certainly seems kind of childlike and naive on the surface.
Oh yeah, there are some movies, like Carl Reiner wrote a couple of the Doris Day Universal comedies, and there's a lot more going on in the material than it might look like at the time. And Norman Jewison, who went on to direct In the Heat of the Night, directed a lot of early 60s comedies. So there's a little bit more artistically, I think, going on. These people were kind of building careers and building POVs for the audience that were happening kind of under the radar, because the films were dressed up as kind of these silly, nice, romantic Technicolor comedies. But there were daily life situations being looked at and discussed, and somewhat humorously, but they were right there.
So in this movie, Sex and the Single Girl, the thing that it's commenting on and struggling with is what kind of roles are men and women going to have in a world that's modern and kind of unhinged. The Natalie Wood character, the psychiatrist, who knows very well how to get ahead and navigate in that world, she's written a guidebook on it, is kind of still a good girl who you know, calls her mom when things go wrong, who wants to have a pretty conventional marriage eventually, but doesn't think that that's what she wants. And the same's true of Tony Curtis. He's supposed to be the most, you know, the bottom of the barrel journalist who will do anything for a story, has no other values than that. He's a kind of a womanizer, has a relationship with his secretary. But all the women in this movie are dominant.
They really are. Lauren Bacall is a very dominant character.
But even the secretary, it's like she's harassing him.
Susan? Oh, how are you feeling?
Fine.
Oh, that's nice. Have there been any calls?
No, darling.
Darling, huh? You call me darling again and I'm going to sell you to the
Reader's Digest.
Dr. Helen Brown says that by being properly aggressive, a girl can land any man she wants to.
Well, you're not a girl, you're a secretary.
I am one of 23 million single girls in this country, and there are only 19 million of you eligible bachelors. Now, what are we surplus girls supposed to do? We're healthy and normal and eager to love and be loved. Dr. Brown says
you
that
read too much. That's your problem. And Dr. Brown doesn't know what she's talking about when she's talking about someone like me, a man with brains and experience. Dr. Brown, I'll bet you this kid has been giving flying lessons and she's never been off the ground. Now, get her on the phone. I want to talk to her.
Yes, darling.
The secretary's coming on to him. He has this girlfriend singer who I just thought was, you know, she's extremely beautiful. She's very much a career girl, not really interested in any kind of future, but would love to have sex with him. But that keeps getting interrupted because the next door neighbors who are married are fighting so much that they can't possibly.
And seemingly the entire world knows about their relationship. The older couple next door. Because when they go to their anniversary party, everyone is deeply moved by them getting together and dancing. And they're doing the twist.
They are, aren't they?
They are.
They're doing the twist, and everyone sees them together after 10 years, and they That's break right. into tears. What is that scene?
Count Basie and members of his orchestra all have tears in their eyes watching these two people that everyone seems to know.
Yeah.
The hosiery manufacturer and his wife. And they're like, oh, so moved that they're twist.
That was, I think, I kind of felt that that fell flat or was strange. I understood it was meant to be as a joke, as a sight gag, but it was just sort of unsettlingly weird to me.
It really is. But I just fundamentally, I went, what? And when that is, when the scene ends, I went back and looked at it again because there's nothing else to that but that. There's no little denouement at the end of it that kind of makes sense. No, that scene is there to provide that information about them. That's basically what it is. Everything you need to know about their life together, their marriage, is in that scene. They've been together a long time. They battle all the time. That's right. He's checking out their hosiery, but she never buys that. And I think it's absolutely, that's truly what he's doing. He's just checking out the competition.
But I think that the fact is that that Joseph Heller is a writer who feels at sea in the modern world. He's critical of the capitalism and the kinds of states that we have now. He's critical of society, and that's reflected in this movie in a variety of ways. But one of the ways is the way that everything is just isn't really supported. You've got these characters who. They don't really, none of them have any kind of foundation. They're all just cartoon-like. And that's actually that feeling is part of his critique of basically Cosmopolitan and the whole thing that he's making. So should we move on and talk about Catch-22 now?
Doc, I don't want to fly anymore.
Why?
It's dangerous.
Listen, I told you. Let's get out of here.
I've flown 35 missions, for Christ's sake.
Take it easy.
Now that sadistic nut has raised the number up to 50. In any other outfit, I would have been rotated after 25. Doc, you've got to help me out.
Look, I'm due for rotation myself in a couple of months if I don't cause any trouble or break any rules. And one of the rules says I can't ground anyone just because he asks me to.
Can you ground somebody who's crazy?
Of course, I have to. There's a rule that says I have to ground anyone who's crazy.
I'm crazy!
Who says so?
Ask anybody. Ask Daly, Todd, McWatt. Hey, Orr, tell him.
Tell him what?
Am I crazy?
He's crazy, Doc. He won't fly with me. I take good care of him, but he won't. He's crazy, all right.
That's proof, isn't it? You're damn crazy.
They're crazy.
And why are you crying now?
Why don't they ask me to cry?
Because they're crazy, that's why.
Of course they're crazy. I just told you that. You can't let crazy people decide whether you're crazy or not, can you? Of course he is. He has to be crazy to keep flying after all the close calls he's had.
Then why can't you ground him?
I can, but first he has to ask me.
That's all he's got to do to be grounded?
That's all.
And then you can ground him?
No, then I cannot ground him. There's a catch.
A catch?
Sure, catch 22. Anyone who wants to get out of combat isn't really crazy, so I can't ground him.
Okay, let me see if I got this straight. In order to be grounded, I've got to be crazy. And I must be crazy to keep flying. But if I ask to be grounded, that means I'm not crazy anymore and I have to keep flying.
You've got it. That's catch 22. Woo!
That's some catch on catch 22.
It's the best there is.
Yeah, and then you move on, as I did right away, into Catch-22. And I was surprised, particularly in the first hour of Catch-22, that kind of the tone was similar for my money. This outsider, this world that makes no sense, broadened into a much larger palette with World War II and so forth. But just the idea of taking the sensibility of I don't understand modern life and placing it in the military in World War II and having an array of characters who all seem kind of hit on the head with a hammer. And I thought there was a linkage that I wasn't expecting, frankly.
There, everyone's kind of, first of all, it's a broad comedy, Catch-22. It's played, it's peopled with mostly comedic actors. You got Bob Newhart in it, for instance. Charles Grodin, he's pretty good in it. Alan Arkin. So it's a big, broad comedy.
Isn't Alan Arkin great?
He really is good.
He's just solid. I just was really, his work impresses me so much when I look at it. Again, it's just, boy, there's a real depth to the...
Yeah, he's solid. He's very good in it, and he's very funny. Mm. And, you know...
John Voight.
Of course. Yeah, John Voight. What a slime ball he is. But, you've got a comedic cast, for sure. And there is that tone, like you say. There's this unreality to their performance, maybe, is how I would put it.
Absolutely. Which fits the military perfectly, I think, you know... But it's genuinely the view of the world is not dissimilar in the two films. There is a view of the world that is marveling at the comedy of it and still marveling at what am I doing here in the middle of it. There's a cartoony edge to it that's in both films that I was surprised about.
This was kind of an experimental movie in a way. It's told out of sequence.
It was a huge budget movie. There were articles and stories about the huge expense of this picture while it was being made, and Paramount was tearing its hair out that they weren't getting the results, and there was a lot of discussion about they spent so much money on the cast, and I mean they bought all those planes. I mean it was expensive, and the talent behind it, Buck Henry had gotten a lot to do the screenplay, and Mike Nichols was a highly sought after director after Virginia Woolf and The Graduate. And it kind of tarnished his reputation to a degree, I think, Catch-22. Because Catch-22 ultimately underperformed at the box office. It came out the exact same time that another movie that cost a fraction and nobody talked about, MASH, came out literally within days of one another.
Okay, yeah, we have to talk about that. I mean, MASH is so much funnier than Catch-22.
Fundamentally a better movie, I think.
Yeah.
And completely under the radar. No one saw that coming. Everybody thought that the movie that MASH was to the audience was what Catch-22 was designed to be. And Catch-22 didn't do that. I think one of the reasons it didn't do it is because it was designed to do it. There was a smugness to it, I think, in the way they put it together. They thought this was going to be the movie, kind of a generational movie. And I enjoy watching it, though. I've enjoyed every time I've seen it. I find it sort of an interesting failure, if you will, on some levels.
I really love MASH. I think it's a great film, but I think Catch-22 is really satirical. I mean, the original material for MASH was just a comic book. It was just a kind of a light comedy and with a bunch of jokes in it, dumb jokes. And you get a great director like Altman on MASH, and he gives it some teeth. But still, MASH I don't think is really as hard-hitting as Catch-22 in its criticism.
I think it is. I think it is, but it's not as it's a little bit more for you to interpret. I don't think it's there as strongly. I think Catch-22 suffers from what a lot of movies, when they are based on a very popular great book, it's so daunting to get it right. And if you're enamored with the material, I think that can work against the movie's overall success, because you don't want to mess it up, and you're being so careful not to make sure that your favorite moments or your favorite characters get that wonderful feeling that you did when you read it, that perhaps it is detrimental to the overall work because you're being careful. When you're making a movie like MASH, it's so open to your interpretation, and there's no prerequisites. There's nobody who's yearning to see these characters put on screen that you can kind of do what you want.
You don't make any sense. You don't even know who you hate.
You've done a persecution call.
You're damn right I am.
You admit it!
I admit I'm being persecuted.
Yeah, by whom?
By them!
But who specifically is them?
Every one of them!
Every one of who?
Every one of who do you think?
I haven't any idea!
Then how do you know they aren't?
Ah! That's sheer, what do you call it?
Sophistry.
Right, sophistry.
Like hell it is, McWatt. Those bastards are trying to kill me!
No one's trying to kill you, sweetheart. Now, you deserve like a good boy.
Oh, yeah? Then why are they shooting at me, Milo?
They're shooting at everyone, you Saurian.
And what difference does that make?
Look, you Saurian, suppose. I mean, just suppose everyone thought the same way you do.
Then I'd be a damn fool to think any different.
You know what you ought to do? You ought to have your head examined.
In MASH, you've got a group of sarcastic, cynical, and rebellious doctors who their job is to repair people who've been hurt, injured in the war. But also, as characters, what they are there to do is comment on a way of life, a system, a war that's going on as they get through it. And they're going to get through it. In Catch-22, you've got a group of bombardiers who their job, they at the beginning of the movie, they think of their job as simply to survive and drop the bombs and not get shot down. But after a while, it becomes that they cannot survive this. And the only thing they can do is try to escape or change the situation. And the situation is just much more intolerable in Catch-22 than it is in MASH.
The craziness is in the weeds in MASH. Like in Sex and the Single Girl, in Catch-22, it's in the authority figures, basically. And it trickles down into society from people who are on top, who are doing, you know, making crazy ideas. In Sex and the Single Girl, the editor of the magazine wants nothing more than to make it a slutty magazine. Is complemented by every negative you say about it. It's backwards to what you would think. Everybody wants to achieve more by doing the worst thing for society. And in Catch-22, the military's goal is to do the worst thing to the individuals it can to achieve its goals.
Really want to reread the novel because it ends up in this dark position and it really wants to be able to have not just a critique, but maybe a suggestion, you know? I mean, like in MASH, even though it doesn't say anything overtly, because it doesn't have to, there's a suggestion as to like how to deal with this kind of situation. Resist, you know, hold on to yourself, be authentic, rebel, and get by and live and survive. But in Catch-22, you can't. That's the whole thing about a Catch-22. You know, you can't do that. So what do you got? You got the, you know, you can make a tragedy, but how do you make a comedy out of that?
I found that the novel had more comedy sprinkled out throughout it. It wasn't lopsided. I think the movie is kind of lopsided that way. Very few people who saw it. I've talked to a few people after I watched it again here just last week. And people who don't remember it vividly still remember what it looked like when the sheet is removed from the bombardier, when he sees him ripped open. That's really a remarkably, I remembered it vividly. It's hard to erase from your memory when you've seen that, particularly on the big screen. It's just, they were not, I mean, in MASH, there's blood and guts throughout the movie, but that one scene in Catch-22 is much more, it's expected and unexpected at the same time. I thought maybe they would not go quite to that distance. And it seems very short when I watch it now, but boy, do people remember it. And boy, did I remember it. And I was kind of dreading that view because I remembered what it looked like so much.
Well, I was dreading it too. I remember that they built up to it is why. It's not actually what you see.
Yeah.
You know, what you see, you might see in a haunted house.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a bunch of guts. It looks like guts. You don't really know what it is. It's the build-up. It's the way you know this is going to end.
It is. The scene is shown, what, four times before it
ends. Yeah. Yeah. And you never get to that point until the very end. And he's, it's, I guess, you know, to be all, do literary theory or something, Snowden represents some sort of innocence.
Yeah.
And feeling that their life can make sense. He's, you know, the main character, Alan Arkin's character, Yossarian, he wants to do right by Snowden. And the fact that Snowden died, it's just something that is gnawing away at him. The fact that happened, it undermines everything else.
Does.
But it's just one example. I mean, there are so many different examples of the corruption of life, basically.
I really do. Honest to God, I never felt anything like this before, not even for my mom.
Men don't fall in love with girls like that.
Men always fall in love with girls like that.
One or the other.
I'm going to take her back to Long Island with me.
But you don't really love her. You think you love her.
How can you tell the difference?
Between what?
Between loving her and thinking he's in love with her.
You have to be objective.
Who's objective?
I am.
Oh, how come?
Because I'm not in love with her.
You mean you think you're not in love with her?
That's right.
Then how can you tell the difference?
Wait a second.
Hey, look.
Woo, look what Alfie's got.
Come on, come on.
Come on.
Let me go. Come on.
Did you see what he did? Make him tell you what he did.
What'd you do, Alfie?
Nothing. Nice girl. Very nice girl.
She wanted us to go home with her. She said she was going to show us a good time.
We had a good time, didn't we? We saw the Colosseum and a lot of other swell sights.
Why didn't you take her home?
Oh, come on now. I wasn't going to take advantage of a sweet kid like that. Old Arthur's got some principles.
Arthur, you've got a diseased mind.
All she wanted to do was jump in a sack with somebody. What's the matter with you?
She's just a little mixed up, that's all. I gave her good talking.
He did!
I straightened her out and sent her home.
He did!
You crazy bastard!
You'll be beneath contempt.
He's got a dirty mind, hasn't he, Yossarian?
The dirtiest.
Well, I don't see it that way.
Come on, you guys. They want us to go home with them.
For how much?
$30. It's a little run.
Snagley's horse kid's sister.
Come on, I want to spend some time with my girl.
I'll pay for all of us.
Why don't you give her the $30 and send the other two away?
Isn't she'll be angry with me for making her work for money? She said that if I really loved her, I'd send her away and sleep with the other two.
I swear, you fellas.
But, you know, we're leaving out the other side of Catch-22, which is not only a societal critique or a political critique, but there's even more dramatically than really Sex and the Single Girl. Because in Sex and the Single Girl, the societal critique is in the background and it's actually more interesting than the question about how the sexes relate. And this, it's the opposite. The way men view and treat women.
And you and I both had the same experience watching it, which was like you didn't remember it being so distinctly about sex. I didn't either, but it is.
It really is. And Yossarian is the one who is supposed to be sane.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
In the movie. But his relationship to women is not good, I don't think. I mean, you know, I'm not trying to, like, be moralistic or anything, but I just don't think it's working very well for him.
It doesn't seem to. I agree with you. I agree with you. Fundamentally, one of the constants in any movie about World War II is how horny the guys are. I've just never seen it portrayed quite so vividly as it did here. These guys are horny.
That woman the woman that's with Orson Welles, his girlfriend.
Yes.
She's not, that's not real. That could never happen.
No, well, he couldn't be there with his son either, but that's... You
know. That's true. But I mean, no, she's in uniform.
I know.
That's no kind of uniform. Come on. That's some sort of sex gear that she's wearing. It's practically, you know, that's just ridiculous. And, but she's very attractive. And very, I can see why people, you know, wow. But everyone, it's kind of like the same scene where everyone's crying.
Yes, it is. That's true. I didn't think, but you're right. It's like, it's way over here. It's way too much, but boy, does it.
I just felt like Yossarian was Alan Arkin did a great job, and he's so, you can identify with him, but I just thought, dude, Yossarian goes off the rails. He doesn't do the right thing. And he doesn't do the right thing, and not just because he takes the deal. But he just, the movie didn't know what the right thing was.
Yeah, I think it's a good point. It's fundamentally flawed in that way because the movie does not take a position.
Yeah, it can't. It doesn't. It's catch 22.
There you go. There you go. That's exactly right.
All you got at the end is this absurdity of him paddling away, and that can't work. So but we're hoping that it will. We feel this like it's a happy ending. So the only way for it to really be happy is for you to admit, oh, this is just a silly movie.
Yeah, but it's far more than a silly movie.
Right. I mean, the scene where he's running away and they're yelling to him and he's running and they're talking to him, they couldn't hear each other. That's not a realistic moment. They've left realism behind.
Well, you don't hear people at several points in the film because of the airplanes, because of the machines of war drowning everybody out.
That's right. In earlier parts of the picture, very realistically, the dialogue is overwhelmed by the airplanes and the machine guns and all of that. In this portion of the movie, he's running away from them through that kind of activity. And they cut to close up and close up, and they're just talking to each other, almost in a normal tone of voice. Not quite. They're yelling back and forth. But in reality, they wouldn't be able to hear each other, and they wouldn't have that conversation. And those two characters also broke character. Asking him, they become like a Greek chorus at the very last scene. So we've left all realism behind.
In the first film, you've got the overarching idea is to make it, is when you get painted into a corner, fall back on silly. You take the authority figures and you take everybody. I mean, the traffic cop who has very little to do in the film suddenly becomes a character that's taken off to an insane asylum at the end of Sex and the Single Girl.
Right.
The one authority figure in uniform, he's taken off. In this film, they turn into something else to provide a point, and it's a little too, I think, a little too heavy-handed, a little too obvious.
Are you crazy? Is he crazy?
If he made it, so can I!
We gotta stop him.
Yossarian!
I can do it, Gambi!
They'll catch you. They'll bring you back.
I can do it.
This is insane.
I can do it.
What about your clothes?
They'll never recognize me without my uniform.
You'll be on the run with no friends. You'll live in constant danger of betrayal.
I live that way now.
Yossarian, for God's sake, hurry up.
So long, Chaplain.
How do you feel, Yossarian?
Fine. Except I'm scared to death.
You'll have to keep on your toes every minute.
I'll keep on my toes.
You'll have to jump.
I'll jump.
Jump!
I want to pick a couple movies this time. Can we please pick a couple movies that are on Netflix streaming? It makes it a lot easier for me if we can do that. And then also people who are listening might be able to watch these movies as well because they may also have Netflix.
Ah, people. What do I care? How about I was thinking of Alfred Hitchcock, Alfred Hitchcock double fill, perhaps?
Oh, that would be awesome.
I was thinking Saboteur and North by Northwest would be a great double bill.
I think those movies on videotape because I have a bunch of Alfred Hitchcock films on videotape.
I don't think you do. I think you have other packages from British period in the early 30s. I don't think you have a Universal film from the 40s as part of that.
Okay.
It's just an idea. I thought it would be. It's a great double feature if you ever run into them, though. Saboteur and North by Northwest. Saboteur is kind of the original version of North by Northwest in a way.
Okay. So do you want to try a couple of different titles or go in a different direction? Or?
Sure. I was thinking Christmas in July and The Palm Beach Story would be a great double bill as well. I'm sorry.
You're killing me here.
That's a heavy sigh.
Well, why isn't neither of these are even available on DVD? Are you kidding me? What?
Well,
why?
I have them both again. I have them on DVD.
Can I throw a couple of titles at you?
Sure.
Okay. Let's see if I can. How about we could go with Schizopolis and like Ocean's 13?
That's funny you should mention that, because the DVD I have of Catch-22 has a commentary track with Mike Nichols talking to Steven Soderbergh all about the movie.
So someday we'll do that. Something we'll do the Schizopolis, because it's actually, I've decided it's one of my favorite movies, which is maybe weird. How about What About Bob? Or what about Bob and The Goodbye Girl? What about Bob and The Goodbye Girl? Can you do that?
No. I don't want to watch The Goodbye Girl.
Come on now.
That's just like, you know, or you could sit and watch people run their fingernails over a chalkboard for 2 hours. How about Pacific Rim and Blade 2?
Pacific Rim is available on DVD only. Let me look at Blade 2. No, they're available on DVD, but not on. So yeah, these other movies weren't even available on DVD. I thought Netflix had a huge library, but
this happens every time we talk about the movie.
Modern problems and the Golden Child.
What is wrong with you? If you saw it on cable while you were sick at some point in your life, that doesn't seem to be really the.
Oh.
That isn't really.
That's not a good movie. Modern Problems. No,
that's right. It's not.
That's not a watchable movie. Chevy Chase.
No. How about, how about Wild Women of Wongo?
Of course I don't have Wild Women. What, is that even a real movie?
Yes.
Wild Women of Wongo. Mm-hmm. Oh, wait. 1958?
Yeah.
Oh, it's available on YouTube.
Well.
In its entirety. So, yeah, I'll do Wild Women of Wongo. What else did you want?
Pretty open to the second one. How about Colossus and the Amazon Queen?
Okay.
There you go.
That's also, it's on freefilmflix.com. And let's see. It's also available on YouTube. So, yes, those are both available on YouTube. Okay, well, that's great.
Wild Women of Wongo and Colossus in the Amazon Queen.
And those are both like 50s B-pictures?
Well, I think you're being kind. They're both 50s. Okay. Wild Women of Wongo was shot in Florida. It's a remarkable movie. It's about these wild women of Wongo, and they're primitive. They're a tribe, and it's all shot in basically a water park in Florida in the 50s.
Great. And then Colossus and the Amazon
King? I have no idea what that is. I don't remember.
You've never seen it?
I don't think so. What I find with a lot of these films is I start watching I remember Wild Women of Wongo, because who can forget Wild Women of Wongo? You just don't. It's right. It's one of the worst films I've ever seen.
All right.
Oh, it's terrific.
Kevin is asleep in front of the TV. He opens his eyes and says hi to me. He's watching the hypnotic eye. It's late, but I decide to give it a try. And someday, oh, someday, it's all to be so easy for me. Riding in a nifty car, everyone will know I'm a movie star. I'd throw away my guitar to be the next John Agar. Bruce and I go to the Jose Theater. 3 flicks for 50 cents, take me to your leader. We're teenagers from outer space. We just let you think we're part of the human race.